So I made the mistake of being honest with David when he asked where I, what I'd been doing while I was traveling, and I said giving talks. So you might wonder why we're still studying white dwarves. They were discovered in 1911, observationally, and so we've known about them for quite a long time. And what I want to try to do for you today is provide some motivation for both the astrophysics community, broadly speaking, and for hopefully getting some condensed matter physicists interested in looking at some physics questions that are coming up because of studies of white dwarves, and in particular their use within astrophysics for different inferences, particularly the age of the universe, as well as exploding as type 1a supernovae. Let me first just tell you why they're called white. They're white because they have a temperature which is around 10,000 Kelvin. When they were first found in the early 20th century, and that ends up sort of being, to an astronomer, white, in the sense that it's a neutral color, 10,000 Kelvin. In the color scheme that optical astronomers adopt, that's a white object. So that's why they're called white dwarves. Of course, now we've seen them in a large temperature range, and so in some sense that's an old nomenclature. But that's why we call them white dwarves, and dwarves because they're extremely small. Their typical radii, I'll sort of show you, it's around that of the Earth, and their mass is around half that of the Sun. So the mean densities are about 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7 times that of water. All right, so what I want to do first is tell you where they come from to sort of set the stage, and then I'll get into some of the basic, some particular problems, as well as their basic properties. So let me start by just providing a brief outline of what I'm going to tell you first, which is where they come from. So this is in the means of sort of bringing everybody up to speed. Sort of gross properties, and in particular things like how we get the mass, the radius, and the mass-radius relation. There's space around here. Don't be shy. Or be shy. Remain shy. Your choice. And then I'll go into, and then I'll provide you a bit of where the current frontiers are and why there's still an active field of research. So let me first tell you where white dwarfs come from. Basically, all stars with masses less than about 6 to 8 times the mass of the Sun make white dwarfs. Roughly speaking, in our galaxy, that's one new white dwarf every 10 years. Okay. And in this sense, they are the most prevalent compact object or stellar remnant in our galaxy. In the local density around us, there are about 50 white dwarfs out to a distance of about 13 parsecs. So there's been, we believe, complete sampling. So the local census is known. This is the local density around the Sun, just to give you a sense of how many there are. That might not sound like many. How are they made? So I need to provide you a 5-minute introduction to stellar structure evolution. And I think I can do it. So I'm going to plot here the luminosity of a star in solar units. This is L Sun. This is a solar unit. And this is the surface temperature, which we call the effective temperature. And just to keep the field clear of interlopers, we always plot the effective temperature backwards. Okay, so that's 3,000 Kelvin. Let's say this is about 10,000 Kelvin. Okay, this is just to keep it clean. No, it's just T plotted backwards. Okay. Okay. It's to, like I said, it's to keep interlopers out, or at least to force them to reveal themselves when they do it incorrectly. And let me just try to get the scale here for what I want to try to exhibit for you today. And this is units of solar luminosity. So here I've got decades of luminosity on this axis, not very much in this effective temperature. 3,000 Kelvin's roughly the coldest I'm going to talk about. So let me start by putting the Sun on this plot. The Sun is, of course, at the solar luminosity. Its temperature is about 6,000 Kelvin. sits about there. That's the sun. That's you. And I'm going to draw with the main sequence. This you all know. This is hydrogen burning stars. These stars are burning in their core, of course, hydrogen to helium. Okay. Now what happens to a star like the sun is in about 5 billion years for our sun, with a total lifetime of 10 billion years, it'll burn out the inner 10 to 15% of mass from hydrogen to helium. You have a pure helium ball. That contracts because there's no internal energy release. From nuclear physics, the only way it can power the energy loss is to contract gravitationally. And it basically does a jog on this plot. It goes up to about here. And on this phase, it has a helium core, okay, and a hydrogen shell that's burning. Okay, so the way to think about this evolution is the helium core, the mass in that core, pure helium, is growing as you go up what we call the giant branch, until the mass in the helium core gets to be about 0.48 solar masses. At that point, that helium core ignites. The helium triple alpha reaction forming carbon occurs, and that's thermally unstable. And we actually don't know what happens there. I mean, just to also point out other holes in the theoretical context, we don't actually understand how the star ends up getting from where we last see it, which is there, to where it reappears, which is roughly over here. Okay? So it reappears on a different part of the diagram. We actually, like I said, we actually don't know theoretically or observationally how the star gets from here to here. Okay? All we know. It's actually hard to say what the observational constraints are on that number, because there's really not. It's really one of these things people don't talk about. Well, if it were days, I think no. It can't be billions of years. I mean, in a diagram of an open cluster or a globule cluster where you really see these distinct points, the frequency of stars going through here is maybe one every. I mean, it's the rate limiting step for getting sent up here is the rate you leave from here. Okay, so. There's one object people have talked about might be in this transition, but theoretically we don't understand it. It's a very violent ignition. It's 0.5 solar masses of helium that suddenly ignites.
Are the nuclear reactions known?
Yeah, the nuclear reaction zone. The problem is completely understanding the three-dimensional aspects of that explosion. So that's an easier problem than the Type 1A supernovae, for which people think we understand. So all we know is it reappears over here, and when you understand the structure of these stars, you understand that it's actually the helium core fully burning. Okay. So at this point, you're converting helium, to carbon oxygen. Okay, in the core. And the star is converting helium to carbon oxygen. It's also burning some hydrogen onto the helium, so this core is growing. Okay.
So this
blows
off a lot of its material.
Okay. In globular clusters, we definitely know that when you go from here to here, you lose something like 2/10 of a solar mass. That's observationally known. Okay. So there is some mass loss from here to here. Okay.
But are solar lines moving to
the left? Well, no. It depends on the amount of mass loss determines where you go. Okay. So I'm going to teach you all of astronomy in 1 hour here. Okay. The amount of mass loss, here's a variable. Right. The reason this isn't unique is because the amount of mass loss varies, okay, in a not understood way, but you can diagnose it. The point I want to make is that these stars are happily burning helium to carbon and oxygen, and of course, the next big event occurs when you run out of helium in the core, and that's when you again, in some sense, go up in this direction, and you, at that point, you have a carbon-oxygen core, which is typically around 0.6 solar masses, okay? And what we see in those types of, and one more thing. This generic evolution, sort of generically speaking, is true pretty much for all stars that are roughly less than, say, 6 solar masses, okay? So this story of the gross picture of evolution is basically the same, slight details, for all stars with masses that are less than around 6 or 8 solar masses. And that 6 to 8 is because for more massive stars, they're able to burn the carbon. Okay, so that's the cut. So we're just going to consider these stars. All right. Now, the other thing to point out is that on this branch of evolution, the the surface is getting quite cold. It's around 3,000 Kelvin. As you can see, the star is very luminous, which means its radius is quite large. And what actually happens in the photosphere is you start forming dust. And this is the dust. By dust, I mean graphite silicate grains. This is the large producer of dust in the interstellar medium are in these stars. And that dust allows the exiting radiation to exert a lot more force on the gas than otherwise you'd get and drive a wind. So what we see observationally from this phase of stellar evolution is large mass loss, in a wind.
What's the connection between high luminosity and forming dust?
You should think of the high luminosity really, there's two issues. One is that there's something called the Eddington limit, which has to do with the radiation pressure relative to gravity. These objects aren't quite in that realm, but they are because the gas isn't ionized, so it's a different, there is a comparable Eddington limit. The luminosity is important for driving, for accelerating the dust grains, and the dust grains are thought to drag along the gas.
Okay. Where do the dust grains come from?
The dust grains come from the fact that you're cold and low enough density that you actually just start having coagulation, if you will. I mean, large molecules forming solids. Okay, the reason I need to say there is this large mass loss is what I'm going to show you next, which are the measurements of the resulting compact objects, the white dwarfs, which are being made in this system. And the way to think about it is as you go up that branch, if I'm the star, I have some carbon-oxygen core, which is, let's say, about 0.6 solar masses when I start going up this branch. There's an envelope out here, which, of course, extends way out to infinity in some sense, which is the other, you know, 2 to 4 solar masses of hydrogen helium. And the question is, does the star burn the material and add it onto the core faster than the envelope goes out to infinity? The envelope can go either way, okay? And observationally, what we know is that this envelope basically gets sent to infinity as a slow wind, okay, roughly 5 kilometer per second wind. So the first thing I need to explain is how is it these objects, what's the mass distribution, the production of these objects compared to that? And for that, I'm just going to show you, I'm going to sort of sketch the plot rather than interrupt the flow to show a view graph. So I'm going to plot now a final mass, which is of the white dwarf, as a function of initial mass of the star. Say 6, 1, 0.6, roughly 1.0. And roughly speaking, it looks like this. If I plotted it, I have data, but I'm going to try to not interrupt the flow. Namely, this is actually what you'd predict if you calculate just that carbon-oxygen core. These would be the data, and the theory in this case would just be saying, well, once you've left this, you're done. The core is fixed. That roughly agrees with the observations. Okay. So the point is that the white dwarf mass is much, much less than the initial mass. And most of the material is ejected. Okay. And so this is the mass range observed, and you can ask me offline how people get the initial final mass relation, but this is now getting pretty trustworthy.
And this linear thing goes on for entire masses?
No, it's it. It peters out at around 6.
Okay, but what's the maximum initial mass before it reaches that, before the core reaches that energy?
Well, I'll show that in a minute. 1.4, roughly. Okay.
Well, that's the mass of the core.
Sorry. I misunderstood your question.
I mean, what's the initial mass?
The initial star's mass that makes a Chandrasekhar mass. The wind doesn't seem to allow that to happen. Okay, so it doesn't occur as far as we know. You could imagine if I shut off the wind, if I didn't have this wind, all these objects would be above the Chandrasekhar mass, and you'd have supernovae going off all the time on this branch of stellar evolution. And that's been talked about. And it's not crazy. And as you go back at high redshift, it actually might start happening a lot. They'd be, to the astronomers here, they'd be sort of type 1.5 supernovae. They'd be hydrogen-rich envelopes that were from core collapse from carbon ignition. So they're funny supernovae. In our galaxy, we don't see those.
Sorry,
confused. So Chandra Sekhar, he ignored the wind in his
calculation? No, no, no. Chandra Sekhar.
There's a different calculation.
I will now show you Chandra Sekhar's calculation. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about cell evolution.
Things on your evolution map?
Sorry, yeah. So this white dwarf will basically cools, and what I'm going to talk about is when we sort of see it in the optical colors, where it reappears down here on a track, okay, where it's 100 times less luminous than the sun, but extremely hot. Okay, and that's why they were called white dwarfs. Okay, they were white and they were small. They could get this much from knowing the distance, since they had the luminosities.
You didn't mention rotation. That's not important.
And I'm not going to the whole talk. No, because we know very little.
Another quick question. When people talk about red giants, do they mean the helium core or the carbon oxygen?
In red giants, they either mean this branch or this branch.
Oh,
if they're being very careful, they should mean this branch. These are red giant branch stars. These are called asymptotic giant branch stars. They're both very large objects, sizes of order in AU, the distance between us and the sun. Okay. I'm not going to get to the frontier at this rate. All right. So everybody keeps mentioning Chandra Sekhar in the 30s. I'm moving now 20 years per 20 minutes. He considered how these stars are supported and showed the importance of degeneracy pressure in holding these objects up, and eventually derived a mass called the Chandra Sekhar mass, above which you can't have degenerate electrons support the object. So let me just remind you of that. And for all of those who are teaching a stat phys course, this is a great exam question. I prefer doing it in the oral context. How do you support a star? Well, hydrostatic balance is just this. That's just hydrostatic balance, where rho is the density of material and g is the gravitational force. So if I just difference this over a star to try to get some estimate of the central pressure, then the density is m over r cubed. That's the gradient. And of course, gravity is gm over r squared. So the central pressure I have to hold up is g m squared over r to the fourth. That's just hydrostatic balance. Okay. And what Chandra Sekhar derived was the resulting mass-radius relation, the relationship between the radius and the mass of an object held up by degenerate electrons. Okay, so the first, if they're non-relativistic, then the pressure of the electron gas is, of course, something like NeE Fermi, okay? And that's NeH bar squared. Okay, Fermi squared over 2ME, right? For non-relativistic particles. And you, of course, relate the Fermi energy just to the density, just in the degeneracy condition. And this says that this is proportional to NE to the 5/3. Okay, once you work that out. And if you equate this to this, you just get the simple relation that R is proportional to 1 over M to the 1/3. And there's prefactors, which I'm going to skip. Okay. So that's the first point for non-relativistic, and that gives us the mass-radius relation when you really do it right. And just to say it, I'm not going to show it, that mass-radius relation has basically been confirmed. There are stars for which we know the mass and the radius separately. You can go and you can measure it. You can compare it to theory, and it works. Okay? So we don't really question the mass-radius relation for white dwarfs. Okay? It's sort of taken as a given. So if you measure one, you presume you know the other. So that makes the science much easier for us. For this relation, though, if I write down the central density, which goes like m, of course, over r cubed, you can see this goes like m squared. So as the mass increases, the central density increases, and eventually the electrons become relativistic. Electrons become relativistic. And then, of course, this relation changes, and this is how you get a mass. E Fermi is then just, of course, P Fermi times C. If you're in the ultra-relativistic limit, this goes as n e to the 4/3. Okay? And if you equate this with this, what you discover is the radius cancels, and you calculate a mass. Okay? So if you put in here m over r to the r cubed, then you can see that basically you get an r to the fourth that shares in common between both, and radius is in some sense indeterminate, and you get a mass, which is the Shannon-Sakhar mass, and I should give you one number that's real. That's 1.46 solar masses. If it's made up of, you have to ask how many electrons there are per baryon. So I'm writing this as A is the mass of the dominant nucleus and Z is its charge. Okay. So there is mass radius uncertainty if you don't know the electron to baryon ratio. But most of these are carbon oxygen, so we actually know it. Okay. All right. So that's basically a rough introduction. And sort of summarizing things that we know reasonably well, I'm also not going to mention magnetic fields. Okay, it's another issue. That's an open issue for white dwarfs. All right. So for gross properties, this is where things were at. And what I want to start talking about now is what's really happening in the field, and in particular, where are there some uncertain problems that are relevant for astrophysics that also I think need some input from a broader community. So what white dwarfs are being used for, sort of two approaches to the problem. One is to ask what white dwarfs can do for us. And the other is the inverse. Okay, I'm going to emphasize what white dwarfs can do for us, though it's not the type of science I like to pursue. But I think for this community, it's probably more relevant. So white dwarfs, how are they being used? Okay. Well, I'm going to emphasize two problems today. They're used to date the age of the universe, which I'm going to explain. Okay, that's what I mean by used. Okay, and they're also used for quote-unquote standard candles, or at least standardizable standard candles, when they explode. To make what are called type 1a supernovae. Okay, so these are the two places where they're being used, and I'm going to emphasize today some of the open questions in both of these contexts. Okay, so how to use them to date the age of the universe? Well, to do that, I need to go beyond just discussing their growth structure and actually start to understand how their internal properties change as they cool, and in particular, are there other heat sources we haven't thought of, and how do we understand the rate at which they cool? Grossly speaking, the simplest possible perspective is they're born hot from the fact that they were burning helium to carbon oxygen, in which case their interior temperature would have been around 2 by 10 to the 8 Kelvin, and after which they just cool. Okay, it's just you just have to ask how much entropy is in that object, what's the rate at which that entropy is leaving, and you can just calculate how fast they cool. And if you go measure one, what I'm going to show you is that we think from measuring a luminosity and knowing the mass, you can actually get the age. Okay. So how do we do that? Well, to discuss that, I first need to give you a little bit more detail about the interior properties rather than just this gross structure. So let me start by getting into a bit more of the physics of the interior. So if I were to draw, again, sort of a poor version of what a white dwarf looks like, it has a carbon-oxygen core. As I'll discuss in a minute, it also has a funny element. This is always my nuclear physics exam. Neon 22, stunned silence. Right? Someone's supposed to say, like David, what in the hell's that? Neon 22, it's not the normal isotope. So I'll explain that. About 2% by mass. Okay? And there's a helium shell and hydrogen out here. Okay, and this we sort of see observation. There's always a little bit of stuff left. You know, the wind doesn't get rid of everything. Okay. So let me discuss the core. So as I already told you, the electrons hold the core up, but the electrons being degenerate basically don't have the entropy. The entropy is all in the ions, okay? Or the nuclei, if you will. or ions, whichever you prefer to call them. And what state are these ions in? Well, to understand what state they're in, we have to ask what's their interactions. And of course, at these densities, remember the density here, roughly speaking, is about 10 to the 7 grams per cubic centimeter. Okay. Coulomb interactions are very important. So let me take one step back. The electrons are degenerate, and for the kinesis matter physicists in the room, we sort of presume they're gelium, okay, just uniform background. And that's a pretty good approximation because the Thomas Fermi screening length is large compared to the ion spacing. But what about the Coulomb interactions of the ions? Well, that's of course the average Coulomb energy. If I want to write down something that's just dimensional, is just given by that, where A is the ion spacing. And if I compare that to KT, so I'm writing the Coulomb energy compared to KT, this thing is always bigger than 1. Okay, for almost the whole evolution of the white dwarf. Okay? So the ions are not an ideal gas. Okay, ideal gas, rather they're a liquid. Rather. They're in a liquid state. When do they crystallize? Well, the one component plasma, the Monte Carlo one component plasma calculations that are done treating the ions classically tell us that when this thing exceeds about 170, they go to a solid state. Okay? And this is a classical one component plasma. This is a 40-year-old result, roughly. you might wonder, for the other side of the community, why I have to have the Coulomb interaction be so high compared to KT to get it to be crystalline. And actually, if you just use the Lindemann's melting criteria, the sort of classical old thing, you get 70 for this. Okay, it's the old surprising thing. I guess the kinetic matter people know it, which is that the Lindemann melting criteria is that, roughly speaking, you can ask if you're in the crystalline state, how large does your vibrational displacement have to be from compared to the ion spacing such that you melt? And that's about a tenth from Lindemann. And if you just sort of do that, you get 70. So this number is bigger than 1, much bigger than 1. And this means that for most of the evolution, the white dwarf core is in the liquid state. That's very important. That really affects...
This is based on Monte Carlo?
So this is one point where I can sort of highlight a piece of physics that needs to be done. And this has been talked about in a paper by Neil Ashcroft and Gilles Chabrier and Hugh DeWitt, which is that this is all done for classical ions. But for high densities or high masses, the densities are actually high enough that you really should do this. This physics needs to be redone as well as other stuff I'll talk about, treating the ions quantum mechanically. Okay. And that's not happened. So one place where I'd sort of encourage people to take a look at is that the quantum treating the ions quantum mechanically needs to be done. And for the first discussion of that, there is a paper by Neil Ashcroft, who you all recognize, Chabrier, in Nature, now about 3 years ago. Nature, sort of 98 or 99. And there's a lot of different things that need to be done. And as you'll see in a minute, the immediate thing is the heat capacity. So why do we care about the ions? We care about the ions because they set basically the heat capacity of this core. And so so if I'm strongly in the liquid state, CV is clearly greater than 3/2, and it's actually I'm going to be a little bit sloppy here. I'm going to write down the classical crystal result just for now. Let me just write it out and then tell you what I mean. If you were the 3 rather than 3/2 is I'm really taking sort of for now just the classical crystalline result, which is of course you get extra 3/2 from what you know and love because of the fact that the positions now have energy associated with them, right? What's mu I? This is just the mi molecular. This would be 12 if it's pure carbon, right? And 16 if it's pure oxygen. Okay. So the thermal content, so the physics of the ions affects the thermal content, and needless to say, that completely affects the rate at which this thing cools. This is the amount of energy in the object. The degenerate electrons are very good conductors, and so the rate at which this object cools is basically set by having to do a calculation of the heat transport through this hydrogen-helium envelope. So if you will, you have to calculate the R value of that overlaying envelope. And for that, I'm just going to give you the current version of the original calculation. So there's an old sort of paper by Leon Mestel. And let me just first give you the relation, because there's one nice bit of algebra which still is held. So let me just show you the result of that calculation. If you pick the core temperature, it's an isothermal core. The electrons are very good conductors. And so all of the temperature gradient occurs in this thin layer. And the current rough number, just to give you a sense for this, is 2.5 times the solar luminosity for a core temperature of 10 to the 8 Kelvin. And this scales to the 7 atoms. This is the old Mestel cooling law. T core, pardon me. Okay, so you can think of this as just, if the core is that hot, what's the rate of energy loss? But I can now just write down a simple equation for the evolution of this object, which is just to say that ddt of the thermal energy, is just going to be, of course, given by that, 3 kb times the mass, uimp, dt core, d time, is minus L, right? That's just the cooling object, with the only presumption being that all of the energy is thermal energy in the core.
Why is this burning
A little bit of burning does go on in those shells. Thankfully, it happens very early on in the evolution. So as I'll show you in one more step, if I put this into here, you can see this is proportional to T core to the 7/2. Okay, and what I want to emphasize is that this basically gives you a simple differential equation. dt core over t core to the 7/2 is minus dt. And so if you're far away from your initial condition, or if you do any damage early on, it's so bright, it sort of goes away. The initial data doesn't matter that much. But it does come in. Then you get the very simple relation, as you can see, between time and core temperature, or if you will, the observable, the luminosity and time. Okay, so this gives you a relationship between T core and time, or better, luminosity and time, mass, let me just write a rough number, 10 to the 6 years over time to the 7/5. Okay? So it cools as it ages in some simple way, and that's when you're far away from your initial data. And far away is just for times much longer than a million years, okay? All right, so now I'm going to start showing you some data. So needless to say, there's a large industry calculating this formula in great detail, okay? And there's another mini industry worrying about the interior physics. And so let me show you the current comparison of theory to observation for this particular bit of science. This plot's quite busy. What it's plotting is the effective temperature, okay, and you can still see the units are Bass ackwards, okay, effective temperature, and the mass of the white dwarf on this axis. The points are individual white dwarfs that are nearby. And so you just put those down on the point on the plot. So here's a 0.6 solar mass white dwarf at a temperature of 9,000 Kelvin. And these solid lines, let's just look at the solid lines, it's all that matters for this point, are where an object would be from this physics where the object would be at an age of 8 gigayears, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3 gigayears. Okay? So this is the sort of current comparison of theory to observation for you just put the object on the plot. So let's say this object, you have the mass and the effective temperature, the surface temperature, if you will, the luminosity, and it says if those two are correct, this object must be at least 8 gigayears old. Okay? That's the current game that's being played. And of course, sweeping under the rug is all of this. I mean, I'm sort of bypassing a lot of physics, and there is uncertainty. Let me now emphasize some of the uncertainties. These calculations quite often don't include a few things. One is the possibility that there's a phase separation upon crystallization between the carbon and oxygen. From that, there is some energy released. It also doesn't include something I'll talk about in a little bit more detail, which is the possible sedimentation of that funny isotope neon 22. But that's sort of where things stand. If you take this and ask what's the oldest white dwarf in the galactic disk, these are nearby. You can see these are on this plot. These are the two oldest, and there's now a few more that are older. But 9 to 10 years is roughly the current best age of our galactic disk, stars in the galactic disk. Okay, and it's from this. It's from this exact technique that one gets that information.
So are there selection effects which make it just hard to see the cooler ones?
Okay. The biggest selection effect here has now, there was one and now it's been understood, was that these objects, when they get around this temperature, if they have pure hydrogen envelopes, what happens is the hydrogen forms molecules. And the opacity gets strange enough that the object in the optical colors becomes blue. So it doesn't just keep getting redder as it cools, it turns blue. Sort of holding its breath. And if you will, now people know that, and so they actually can find them. Okay, and so there are now some much colder ones that are showing up. But there really was a selection effect previously. So the new ones that I don't have on this plot are filling in this region, okay, and that's why I'm saying the current age is around 10.
Can we see white dwarfs in other galaxies?
Not as they cool. You see them when they explode, but not as they cool. Yeah. You see white dwarfs in distant globular clusters in our galaxy, and let me just tell you the result from that. There have now been very old white dwarfs found in globular cluster M15 in our galaxy, and the age of those is around 12 to 13 gigayears. Okay? Clearly older than this. The age for current cosmology is what? What's the favorite number?
14.
Okay? So that's reassuring. The age of the main sequence stars in that cluster are about 13.2 gigayears. So you can ask, yeah, that's a fair question, you can ask, okay, this all looks great, but how do you actually know it's right? In the sense that this is a pure theory, okay? The only point at which the only place where it's really been confirmed is in that one old globular cluster where the main sequence star age and the white dwarf age agree, okay? For these that are in the field, this is actually untested, okay? This theory has really not been tested. You can't really test the theory in this context. Okay.
I was to say, I missed the point. I mean, from this we conclude the universe has to be older than whatever was 9 billion years.
Well, there's two points. There's two points. Okay. So there's two points I want to make. One point is that the theory has only been tested in sort of one environment, which is in very old globular clusters. What I mean by tested is where you have an independent confirmation of the inferred age.
Of the age of the cluster.
Yeah. Okay. For our galactic disk, for these stars, we actually don't know how old they are, okay? But you put them on this plot, and you get if the white dwarf cooling theory is correct, you'd say they're 8 gigayears old. Okay.
But we have other tests of the age of the galaxy.
We have other... dating the galactic disk is, I mean, yeah, 8's fine. I mean, people are happy with 8 to 10 gigayears, but... I mean, I'm trying to think how else you can do it. I mean, you know it's at least 5 from the sun. But, you know, maybe we were captured because of Sagittarius, you know, dwarf galaxy came in, and we were part of some other.
So the idea might shed some light on galaxy formation when it is formed and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that this is a distinct time from the globular clusters makes a lot of people happy.
So
that this
talk
is,
about
yeah.
the age of the white dwarf, you're counting from when?
For these white dwarves, if they're really, let's say these more massive ones, there's no penalty, really, for the time you had to spend burning. And that's what's actually shown by these dash lines. I didn't want to get into that. This dash line is giving that penalty for the fact you had to have the star evolve. But if they're 0.8 solar masses, then forget it. You know, all that matters is the cooling. Okay. All right. So let me just show you, to give you an example of damage you can do. Let me just first show you this plot. So for example, if you say to yourself, well, I don't really want it to crystallize, what would happen to the luminosity versus age if I just sort of shut my eyes and say it stays in a liquid phase? Okay, that would be this blue line. The red line is a line showing the fact that you actually allow the heat capacity to diminish dramatically after you've gone crystalline, particularly when you're in the Debye part of the cooling curve. That's shown by this line. So this gives you an idea of just an impact of the physical assumption that you've gone into a crystalline state, okay? Just to give you some feeling for that. Okay. So now in the last 10 minutes, what I want to switch to, I'm going to skip a lot of stuff here, is their role in type 1a supernovae. So let me turn this off. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about is what else white dwarfs can do for us, and that is their role as standard candles, if you will, for type 1a supernovae. So if I have a carbon-oxygen white dwarf, as I showed you, they typically have masses of 0.6 to 1. Okay. If I go to the center of one of those objects and I plot let me first plot core temperature versus central density, just schematically. So let me just explain how we think white dwarfs form type 1a supernovae. Huh?
Which way does temperature go?
This is a physicist plot, so this will be up. Okay? I can plot on here one thing first, which is how hot or dense do I need to be so that the carbon ignites? And roughly speaking, I'm just going to draw this schematically, sort of a curve that kind of looks like this. Maybe I've gone a little bit too. Phil's going to correct me, right? Phil, you'll straighten me out. This is a curve where on this side, a carbon burning beats, in this case, it's actually neutrino cooling. There's neutrino emission from the cores of these objects. So on this side, so if the center of the white dwarf hits this line, or any part of the white dwarf hits this line, that fluid element will start generating energy. Okay? Now if I take an old white dwarf like the ones I just showed you, they typically have a center point that's sitting here around 10 to the 7, temperature say of 10 to the 7. And if I drew their profile, how the temperature changes with position, it's sort of isothermal. Okay? Now, what we observe as what are called type 1a supernovae, are explosions consistent with burning 0.5, more than 0.5 solar masses to nickel 56, okay, and unbinding the object, unbinding. The object. Okay, that's what you see. We see these events. You see radioactive decay that tells you there's been roughly that much solar masses of nickel produced. And the fact that the thing has exploded tells you it's unbound. So this is what's observed, and these are called type 1a supernovae. We don't actually know what the initial mass of the object was. Okay? If it were near the Chandrasekhar mass, you need to ignite, you need to convert at least this much to release enough energy to even get the thing to be gravitationally unbound. Okay? Just to ask, you know, to get the thing to become unbound. So how does that happen? How do you get a white dwarf where I just told you most of them sit, if anywhere, sort of around here, they don't get that massive. How do you actually, what's the scenario, or how do you actually get one of these objects to explode? And the current picture that the community has is that these happen in binaries, where one of these white dwarfs finds itself in a binary, and mass accretion onto the white dwarf increases its mass. And of course, if you increase the mass, I already showed you the central density rises. Okay, and there's a trajectory for the central point, which eventually puts it on one of these, hitting one of these places where it'll subsequently ignite and explode. Okay, so a very important problem is to understand how that happens, and in particular, what environments allow you to have the mass increase. So let me just give you a few examples of what could happen, and then tell you a little bit about why it's a hard problem. You could say, well, let's just do it. Let's have the mass increase, and let's do it very rapidly. Let's just take this white dwarf, put it in a binary, have mass go on at an arbitrarily high rate, in which case this compression of the core would just be adiabatic, right? You just take the core, and you just compress it adiabatically. Okay, that's the sort of the simplest thing you could do. And again, I'm going to get it wrong, but let me just draw in here and say, just say that's the adiabat. Okay? So that's a possible solution. What it, of course, any of these require is accretion of up to, so sorry, let me just say it and explain why. There's one piece of physics I didn't explain yet. Why do we have to add this much material? Well, there's a conspiracy in the physics, or some would claim a just so, anthropic argument, which I despise, and that's recorded, so in history, which is the following. This ignition curve, as you can see, eventually turns over, and this is due to the fact that these ions are very strongly correlated. Okay, so there's a density above which, if you will, the zero-point motion is what's providing the center of mass energy, okay, for the fusion reactions. That density is very high, so the physics of the Coulomb physics and the nuclear physics fixes this density. Okay, that density happens to be so high that to ignite on this side, you have to be very close to the Chandrasekhar mass. Okay? So that's just sort of how it ended up. If, for example, this were a helium white dwarf, that wouldn't be true. You'd only have to have, I forgot the number, 0.8 or something. So you don't have to be close to Chandrasekhar. But for carbon, that's what happened. That's what's required. So you have two choices. You either get it to sort of stay cold and ignite here, or you do an adiabat and you get it to ignite here. And of course, where you ignite on this curve is determined, is your mass. Your mass is known at that point. Okay, so the fact that there's diversity in the supernovae, which we see, is perhaps not surprising given the diversity of ignition conditions you can get. Okay. So why is this hard? Why is it hard to come up with an environment where you can successfully put on 0.3 solar masses of material and have the white dwarf increase in mass? That's the question that I'm going to discuss in the last 10 minutes. And it's hard for the following reason, is that if you think of any scenario, what you're going to be adding is hydrogen and helium. You're going to be a companion of a normal type star, and you're adding a hydrogen and helium. So you're adding hydrogen and helium onto the white dwarf surface. Okay, and the problem is that fusion of that hydrogen and helium, or let's say fusion of hydrogen to helium, of course, releases 7 MeV per nucleon. Okay? The gravitational binding energy is 100 kilovolts per particle. Okay? So the problem, the fundamental problem with this, or the challenge, if you will, to this scenario is how does the fusion of the accreted hydrogen allow the accreted material to stay bound, accreted matter.
What's the escape energy?
100 kilovolts. Okay, the gravitational energy, which is Gm, baryon mass, divided by R, is 100 to 300 kilovolts, depending on the mass. Okay?
So the hydrogen fusion is occurring in the
envelope,
right?
Pardon me?
The hydrogen fusion occurs, it occurs in the envelope.
Yeah, it occurs in the envelope. That's right.
It could have an implosion.
Well, so let me tell you what. So this is the problem. Okay, this is the fundamental problem for this, or the problem or challenge to this scenario. Okay, is that most anything you can think of, you'd have a binary with a normal star. You're creating hydrogen, and how does the hydrogen fuse and stay bound? Okay, and so let me. So that's the. So I need to sort of describe. That's what you've got to do. You've got to, in this scenario. You've got to have the mass increase, otherwise you'll never get it to ignite unless you can somehow get it up to here. The type 1A rate in our galaxy is maybe one every, I want to say, 200 years. Someone should correct me if they know the number. It's not that, huh?
Yeah, two, is that, 300 years.
Two or 300 years? And one in, and there's one born every 10 years, so one in 20, one in 30, right. Yeah. Okay.
Actually,
so half of stars, like people, half of stars are in binaries, okay?
I don't get, I mean, before okay, they were white dwarfs, they were red giants.
Right. Okay, so I...
What happens to the binary during a red giant?
Okay, period? Yes. Okay. I'm going to teach a course soon, David. So roughly half of stars are in binaries, okay? And they like to have, roughly speaking, they like to be with an equal mass companion, broadly speaking. But there's always one more massive than the other, and the more massive one evolves first, just because the stellar evolution, the more massive stars burn their fuel faster. So that when that star goes up the red giant, it starts getting large, what can happen is, depending on the orbital period, it will eventually have a tide. So let me just give you an example. So a four solar mass and a sun. Okay, the four solar mass star evolves fast. If the orbital period is a few years, then basically nothing happens. There's no modification of stellar evolution until the object gets so large that the one solar mass star starts to pull material off and try to basically rip the tidal forces of the material off. However, if you try to take mass from a four solar mass to a one solar mass star, that's dynamically unstable. and so what happens in that scenario, if you fill what's called fill the Roche orbit, have a dynamical mass transfer, when you're already on the giant branch, so you have to have an initial orbital period that's large, is you basically, sort of all hell breaks loose with this envelope, which fills the binary, fills, let's say, a few astronomical units of space. Then you have this carbon-oxygen core and this one solar mass star in that volume, which is filled with the envelope. And then, out of sheer desperation, what a theorist says, is you can ask, how much gravitational binding energy do I have to put into that envelope to send it to infinity, and therefore what would be my final orbital period? Okay? So you have these egg beaters, if you will, spiraling together. That's called a common envelope evolution. And what it tells you is that you can actually, if it depends on how efficient that process is, but you can actually get the system to be rather close at the end. So you might get from a year down to, say, 5 hours. Okay, that was shown by... That was really Bonin-Pachinsky back in the 60s. That's what you need for these systems. Okay? What's wrong, Tony? Oh, yeah, Joe, right, Joe. Okay. So that's the story. Okay? And that's how you then eventually get mass transfer. Okay? So it was a puzzle when people saw white dwarfs in five-hour orbits. They said, how in the hell did you do that? Okay, because, you know, to get the job. So that's how it happens, we think. Okay. So, in the interest of not keeping you here longer than you want to be, let me just describe a little bit about what this problem.
So you just mentioned massive. There are cases where one can see the binary.
Yes. So, We definitely have many of these systems where we have a white dwarf that's accreting matter onto it, and those are the systems that actually where you can actually study what happens when you put hydrogen on the envelope of this white dwarf. Okay, so we know of those systems; they're prevalent in our galaxy, and you see them in other galaxies as well. Okay, so what happens? What we observe in most cases is you add this hydrogen and helium onto the white dwarf. And what happens is it accumulates for a finite time, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, depending on the accretion rate. Eventually it gets hot enough to ignite, ignites, hydrogen ignites, explodes, and blows off that material. Okay? So we see what are called classical novae, which are the explosion of accumulated material, and ejected to infinity. Okay, you see these events. These are really bright events. You see them in our galaxy. You see them in M31, and they're actually showing up now in a lot of. So M31, these are easily observed. So the question is, does the ejected mass, which the observers think they can measure, how does it compare to what you accumulated? Okay. So what's the sign of the M dot? Okay. That's one thing you'd like to know. You'd like to know if these systems, yes, they eject material, are they ejecting more or less than what a theory would tell you they should accumulate? Okay. That's one question. The other question is, of course, if they were always, so let me back up. I mean, obviously, energetically, okay, if I really have a sudden event and it's very efficient, I can excavate, right? I have 7 MeV per nucleon, and this is the gravitational binding energy. So if I wanted to be bold, I could actually excavate, you know, a factor of 10 more material. Okay? And I'll tell you right now that some of these events see carbon and oxygen abundances that are 50% by mass, and you know you can't make that via fusion during this reaction. So that already tells you that in some instances there's dredge up, or if you will, excavation. Okay, which is sort of not going to help this problem. Okay. All right. So I don't want to. So what should I show you? So what I want to briefly just show you, and I'm going to bypass the explanation of how we do it. One thing that's going on here locally, which is work that Dean Townsley, who's in the audience and will correct me, and I've been working on, which is for those systems that undergo these classical novae, what is the core temperature? Okay, what is the core temperature of those objects? Okay. Well, we can see that, thankfully, because these objects, let me show you a little bit of data, and then I'll shut up.
These explosions happen periodically? Build up material at a
Okay, the typical recurrence time you'd expect is 10 to the 4 to 1,000,000 years. So yes, but we don't see it. Okay. If the white dwarf is very massive, then you actually get to the critical pressure faster because gravity is high, and then maybe you can get the recurrence time down to 50 years. Okay. There are systems which show multiple classical novae. The astronomers then call them recurrent novae, but we think it's the same physics. Okay. So in a few of these systems, thankfully, there are times when the accretion shuts off, and you can actually see the white dwarf. So these are, thanks, Doug. So let me just show you briefly a little bit of data. So this is a system which is accreting at a very low rate. That's its GWLib is its name. Variable star naming is very arcane. But what you see is there are times when this accretion shuts off, and you can actually see the white dwarf photosphere. So what you're seeing here are lines. This is the hydrogen line. So here's the Balmer H alpha, H beta, H gamma. So the Balmer line transitions, and you can actually see the white dwarf. So this is the white dwarf photosphere. So for many of these systems, the observers have been able to measure the surface temperature. And let me just briefly show you that data. And they can measure it as a function of orbital period of the binary. So first, to see that yes, there are white dwarfs in binaries with periods of one all the way down to sort of almost an hour, and longer. I'm just showing you the short orbital period. So here they are. These are white dwarfs in binaries with main sequence type stars. These systems have companions which are donating material which are probably 2/10 of a solar mass main sequence stars. But these are the effective, these are the surface temperatures of these systems. And what we've been trying to understand is, can we actually explain these data? And in particular, can we understand what the core temperatures that are implied are? And you're going to have to ask me separately to explain how we do it. But there's two things we can calculate. And it relates to this classical Novi problem as well. So I'm going to cut to the chase. What we actually have done is to calculate the reheating of the white dwarf due to adding material on and having it come on and leave, come on and leave. And to do that, you have to not only find the core temperature, but you also have to find this ignition mass. How much material do you have to put on the white dwarf to get it to explode? So it's constantly going through this limit cycle of accumulating and igniting. And shown here are the recent calculations that Dean's been doing for different masses of white dwarfs. What's the ignition mass as a function of the rate of accretion, the rate of material you're adding onto it, and what's the core temperature? So the first thing to see is these core temperatures are around 10 to the 7, so they're actually pretty cold. They're sort of on this branch, okay? So if you want to get one of these guys to ignite, it has to be very close to the Chandrasekhar mass, so it would have to be something probably of order 1.2 or higher. But the other point I want to make is we're actually now calculating this ignition mass. For the few data points that exist, if you ask what's the measured ejected mass, okay, there are some below 10 to the minus 5, which is down here, okay, and there are a fair amount that are between 3 and 5 by 10 to the minus 4. Okay, so this is sort of early days for comparing theory to data, but the first thing to say is that it's not so clear to us from our work that it's always the case that the ejected mass exceeds that you need to ignite. Okay, and this, of course, all has to do with the hydrodynamics of the process, right? If there's any radiation cooling, then, of course, not, that energetic argument I just gave you breaks down. Okay, and just to say, we can also explain, I'm not going to show that plot, but we can also, well, I can show it. Dean wants me to show it. It's a great plot, but I think for this audience, there's too much on it. These are the data of the effective temperatures, these surface temperatures, as a function of the orbital period of the white dwarf. And here's our theory prediction for a 0.6 solar mass white dwarf and for a 1 solar mass white dwarf. So these are really, if you will, I hate to say ab initio, but that's what they are. I mean, if it didn't agree, we'd be in big trouble. There's not much wiggle room here. But what this is also probably telling us is that these white dwarfs are a little bit probably more massive than 0.6. Okay. And that's also important because it says during this evolution, you start having mass transferred. If, of course, you have to accumulate 0.3, you can also ask, well, how much do I have to flux? How much materials have to have been put on the white dwarf? And if you believe you always eject, say, twice what you accumulate, then after you've put on 0.3, the white dwarf would be 0.3 solar masses lighter. And actually, that we completely rule out. Okay, so from theoretical work we've been doing, we're getting indications that these white dwarfs, which have probably had a lot of mass put onto them, have actually, on average, increased. Okay, which might open up, if you will, this channel. This to tell you, the community basically has dismissed this as a channel to make type 1a supernovae because of this inference that everything's ejected. Okay, that's sort of where things stand. And so what we're really asking is that a plausible...
What's the other channel?
Okay. Yeah, so to wrap up, what are the other channels? So the prime channel is one that's a very narrow channel, but one in which you tune the accretion rate so that you burn the hydrogen at exactly the rate you accrete it. Okay? So there is an accretion rate at which you'll burn the material in steady state, just at the rate you accrete it. That range, the dynamic range of that accretion rate is about a factor of 2. Where the white dwarf can accommodate it. And so that's a thin bit of parameter space, which is why we've been doing sort of work on a broader parameter space. There are many, many more of these systems that maybe are harder to understand, but there's a lot more phase space for those than there are for the others. Okay, so to just wrap up, sort of hopefully giving you a rough idea that for type 1a supernovae, there are some fundamental puzzles. And in particular, what are the binary scenarios that actually allow you to have the white dwarf mass increase? But also, you can already see that things like the age of the white dwarf when accretion starts can also matter. The white dwarf are very old when it starts accreting. This central point is sitting, say, down there. And of course, then the adiabat I draw would be different. And those are issues that are still under active work. But in terms of sort of pieces of physics that have come up where we really don't know, I only really emphasize one here. There's other ones I wanted to emphasize, and I'll just briefly mention. There's a lot of interesting questions of what the carbon fraction is in the interior. As you can imagine, this curve depends on how much carbon there is, and what is that fraction of the carbon to oxygen. There's uncertain nuclear physics in predicting that. That has to do with reaction rates of the alpha carbon to oxygen 16 reaction. But there's also questions of diffusion and relative diffusion. And so one thing that is also in need of physics input is really understanding the dynamics of the liquid state of this material, and in particular, diffusion dynamics, or if you will, the diffusion coefficients of carbon, oxygen, and also other species. And that's something that hasn't really been looked at in detail. So a real understanding of the time it takes, well, what we really need from the input for the microphysics side is a diffusion coefficient in the liquid state. And that would tell us whether there's adequate time for the imprinted carbon-oxygen fraction that's imprinted from evolution. There is, if I plot the carbon fraction in the interior of the white dwarf, there is less of it in the interior than the exterior. And you'd like to know, is there time for that to be undone by diffusive processes? That would modify this ignition curve quite a bit. And to do that right now, basically, we don't have the dynamics we need. And so another 30 minutes I could have talked about were uncertainties in these diffusion coefficients, which right now, to sort of put terror into the condensed matter community's heart, I'll tell you how we do it, okay? Which is we use the Stokes-Einstein relation. That's supposed to make you... Okay, if you don't know it, then too bad. But it's not, these diffusion coefficients haven't been calculated. So we've basically been estimating them from calculations of the viscosity of the medium, if you will. Okay. So these are sort of maybe factor of five estimates. And the rough diffusion time is of order of 5 gig years. So the problem we've got is that if you make an estimate of the diffusion time and ask how long does it take the particle to diffuse across the white dwarf, it's sort of 5 gig years. But then unfortunately, that's exactly the time that matters. And so factors of 2 in the diffusion coefficient really make a difference. Okay. Usually that doesn't occur, but in this case it actually has been a big problem for making progress on a lot of this diffusion. So at that point I'll stop. Thanks.
Honest, you didn't explain why this matters for using supernova standard candles, because in the end you're going to end up with this curve. Anyway.
Yes.
So who cares how you get there?
There's sort of two answers to that. The immediate trivial answer is that the mass that you have, that the white dwarf has along here, will vary. So up here it's near to Shannon-Sakhar, but over here maybe it's 1.2. Okay. So the immediate trivial answer to your question is that it can definitely change the total mass of the object when it explodes, and that would affect the light curve. Okay. How that affects the light curve, nobody can tell you. Okay. Because right now, if you ask when people do light curve variability, what do? They always presume the same mass, and the only variable they put in is the amount of nickel you make. That's the current cut at what's the one parameter. Is that the mass is fixed, but the amount of nickel you make is a variable. This argument would say maybe you should consider the fact that the total mass might be different.
Is there a chance that one parameter is just location along that curve?
Once you've hit this curve, then the question is, how does the system evolve? How does the object evolve? And when you hit this curve, all that happens at that point is you start generating internal energy, entropy, if you will, and that point starts to rise. And it doesn't actually explode until the burning time becomes comparable to the dynamical time in the white dwarf. There's a period, intervening period of 1,000 to 1,000,000 years when it's in this sort of, if you will, sort of simmering stage. And that's actually not been well studied at all. And that might well make a difference for how the explosion evolves. I mean, the cosmologists know this. The kinetic matter people might not appreciate it, that the use of type 1a for cosmology is entirely empirical. It's not like, say, the CMB, where you know where you think you understand all the physics and you can actually use it. It's entirely an empirical exercise. Okay, so you know, in some sense, one could say you know you could care less about the theory. It's an empirical exercise.
Well, it's based also on this theoretical prejudice that they all come from general psychology.
There's two answers, sort of yes and no. Okay, yes, say 10 years ago, okay, when people didn't see that there was a diversity in the type 1a supernovae, right? Now we know, and we know that you wouldn't be able to do the cosmology if you didn't account for the diversity, that the light output varies by a factor of 10. Okay, the integrated light output varies by a factor of 10. Okay, that's completely empirical. It's an empirical result with an empirical correction, which is presumed to be the same here as it is 5 years ago. So you might tell about my tone, my belief in the system. Okay, great.
Any other questions?
Are there any effects from axions or other
particles? So far, you know, it's like most things in astrophysics, right? Until there's a problem, you don't really invoke yet another particle, right?
Well, then at the point is, you want to sort of feel out what you can do to change your theory.
Sure. Yeah, so for white dwarf cooling, okay, there, if I make a list of pieces of physics that we know we have to account for that we haven't, that already involves carbon-oxygen crystallization, fractionation, which can affect the ages by up to 10 to 15%. Chris Deloy, I don't know if he's here, and I have been working on sedimentation of neon 22, that funny isotope, into the center of the white dwarf, which can also have a comparable modification. We think the calculation of the R value is pretty solid at this point. So the L, the luminosity core temperature relation, is probably in pretty good shape. That physics is pretty well understood. And so if you want to add into that presence of, say, other particles which sort of break all these, you know, you're free to do so. But I think, you know, you can't do factors of two damage, right? And I don't know what that implies. I haven't looked at that.
Right? I thought neutral current cooling plays a role in some stars, is that right? Neutrino air?
Yeah, neutrino, yeah. Neutrino. Yeah, but for white dwarf cooling at this stage, it's all, you know, conduction and radiation, it's all making photons, yeah. It does matter elsewhere, though, definitely, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.